Buddhist Summer School, Saturday, 28th August, 1982. I would like to make it quite clear, first of all, that I do not arrogate to myself the word teacher. I am not your teacher. Teaching takes place if and when there is a communication between one person and another, and if that other person benefits in some way, is enlightened in some way or helped in any way, then that confers teacherhood upon the person who has so helped him. And only in that sense there is a real teaching, otherwise it isn't. The backs of ducks do not allow water to stay upon them. Whatever is said, whatever one attempts to teach, if one deliberately wants to teach, is like water off a duck's back, really. But if, for some reason or other, the human duck can imbibe that water and utilize it for his benefit, then, of course, the person who has poured the water has succeeded in teaching him something. But the person who pours the water doesn't know that, and he shouldn't know that. He just does his work and then leaves it to the life process to do the rest. Now, I would like this afternoon for all of us to consider together certain things. The best mode of communication is by considering together, which involves a very careful, attentive listening to what is read or said. And this attentive listening, if it is to be true attention, ought to be free of any preconceptions and any sort of chattering back by the brain at what is said. Of course, this is extremely difficult. I myself can't do it when I hear somebody else speaking. All our conditioning, all our beliefs, our ideas, our preconceptions, they are always at play. And the brain holds all that. And the brain is the villain of the piece. It will not stop talking. It will talk back at every impulse, stimulus, impression that comes to it. It will talk back at it at once, more or less. Either talk back in terms of agreement or disagreement or whatever it may be. But it is best to let the talking cease, because when the brain really can stop talking, then mind in its purity and in its fullness begins to be operative through us. And that mind is not your mind or my mind. None of us have mind. Mind is something universal, just like consciousness. It is the psyche which does all this. I'll talk a little more about it during the course of the week, the difference between psyche and mind as such. Now today, let us consider, why do we take to religion, or why do we turn to religion? Some people are born with a natural, with an active interest in religion. Those people are very, very rare. They respond, there's something in them which responds to transcendence as such, straight away. I rather think that children, after their birth of course, have this sensitivity which will respond to the transcendent, whatever it may be, and in whatever form it may come to them. But later on, because of the child's conditioning, the influence of the parents, the friends, the circumstances, the events which take place, all the influences of TV and games and all the rest of it, all that plays its part and tends to shut out this responding to transcendence. The best response takes place only when we are silent. When I am silent, the king speaks. I think some of you at least, if not all of you, know that wonderful story about Paderewski. He was invited once by the Tsar of Russia to give a recital for him, for his pleasure, and the court. Paderewski went, he started playing, and they all started talking. Paderewski immediately took his hands off the piano and just waited in silence. And the Tsar inquired, "What's the matter with the man? Why can't he play?" Paderewski answered, "Sire, when the Tsar of all the Russias speaks, it's the duty of all else to be silent." Now, are we born with an active interest in religion? Or are we conditioned from infancy by parents and others to accept or at least nominally belong to the religion to which the parents belong? Or do we turn to religion in order to solve some of our worldly problems, whether it be of health or of business or human relationships or whatever they are, to cure us of our misery? What does religion mean to the world? Note, not just a particular religion with its doctrines, dogmas, teachings and procedures and so forth, but religion at its very heart, the actual reality which is religion. What does it mean to the world? Mostly, it is an acceptance of creeds, of forms of ritual worship, of hymns and prayers, of homage and adoration, of praise, of petition and intercession. And it also means, to a small degree with the mass of human beings, a way of life expressing an ethical code individually, socially, and in relation to whatever is postulated as felt to be transcendent. Take, for example, the Christian creed. It's a very good example. We believe in one God, the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, and of all things visible and invisible. And in one Lord, Jesus Christ, the alone born Son of God, begotten, not made. Begotten of his Father before all ages. It's a very important point. Before all ages. God of God, light of light, very God of very God. That is to emphasize the essence of the whole thing. Begotten, not made. Being of one substance with the Father. Begotten, not made. It means life is at work. The livingness of the situation is there. By whom, being of one substance with the Father, by whom all things were made, who for us men and for our salvation came down from heaven and was incarnate of the Holy Ghost and the Virgin Mary. And this is the thing that the hundreds of millions never have understood and still don't understand. And was made man. and was crucified also for us under Pontius Pilate. He suffered and was buried. And the third day he rose again according to the scriptures and ascended into heaven and sitteth on the right hand of the Father. This is, of course, a way of talking to children, even though they may be grown up. My sister's late father-in-law used to talk of human beings as, in Gujarati, nalla bachcha ne motta bachcha, little children and big children. And he shall come again with glory to judge both the quick and the dead, whose kingdom shall have no end. And we believe in the Holy Ghost, the Lord, the giver of life, who proceedeth from the Father and the Son, who with the Father and the Son together is worshipped and glorified, who spake by the prophets. There is perhaps the strongest link with us human beings. And we believe one holy Catholic and Apostolic Church. We acknowledge one baptism for the remission of sins, and we look for the resurrection of the dead and the life of the world to come. This doctrine of resurrection begins with Zarathustrian teachings. It was in Zarathustrianism that the idea of resurrection was first put forward. Not in the Christian form, in its own special form. And as you know, Zarathustra flourished long before Christ. Most scholars think about 6 centuries before Christ. I think there is internal evidence in the original teachings of Zarathustra, the Gathas as they are called. There is internal evidence to show that Zarathustra may have been contemporary with Abraham. And if we accept the date of Abraham, about 2000 BC, then Zarathustra flourished about 3000 BC and gave these teachings. Since I've mentioned Zarathustra, this is the Zarathustrian code, credo. I will come to Buddhism quite quickly now. Come unto my aid, O Mazda. The Zarathustrian name for, it's a theistic religion, for God is Ahura Mazda, Lord of life and of wisdom. Mazda is wisdom. Ahura is life. I am a worshipper of Mazda. Interesting, wisdom. 3000 BC. And as a Mazdaeshni, follow a Zoroastrian, I declare myself to be an ardent believer of this faith. I solemnly dedicate myself to good thoughts, well conceived, good words, well spoken, and good deeds, well performed. I confess myself dedicated to the pure and good Mazdaeshni religion, which disarms and ends all strife. Perhaps sort of teaching needed nowadays, particularly. Teaches self-sacrifice and leads to righteousness. Of all the religions that exist, or that shall be, the greatest, the best, and the noblest is the religion of Ahura. Here you get mentioned life, Ahura, revealed by Zarathustra. All good cometh from Ahura Mazda, life and wisdom. Such is the solemn dedication of the faith of a Mazdaeshnian. Now, both the Christian credo and the Zarathustrian credo as such have very little say in the world, very little influence. We have become so concerned with what we call the conquest of nature and so forth, that we have effectively shut out the transcendent life which should be flourishing in us. Now, in Buddhism, we have the three refuges. I'm not suggesting that this is a credo, but it could lead to the feeling within a person which would exist in a devout theist also. Buddham saranam gacchami, Dhammam saranam gacchami, and Sangham saranam gacchami. I go to the Buddha as my destination. I don't like the phrase, I take refuge in the Buddha, or taking refuge. The idea, the English word refuge makes us feel that we are running away from something. I prefer, saranam also means a port of destination. It means a destination. So I prefer the idea that I have as my port of destination the Buddha, who is the embodied wisdom and compassion. That is the more important part. And similarly, I go to my destination, which is the teaching, the way, and the Sangha, the order, the community. Because we all function, every single one of us functions in the world, not merely as a separate individual, but as integral part and parcel of a great community. Integral part and parcel. That is to say, not just number one, PC 94 or something like that. Integral part and parcel, which means that we are intensely more interrelated and interacting with each other than we are aware of or we can imagine. This is something to which the Buddhas completely awake. You see, when the Buddha reaches his enlightened state, his consciousness has become, in the true sense, a cosmic consciousness. That is to say, it is not his personal vijnana, his personal discriminative consciousness, which has just expanded into a vast ego consciousness. Not at all. The vijnana is an ego consciousness. This is a case of that which was separate has completely dissolved all separateness and has become reintegrated, reinstated into the totality. That is the ultimate fulfillment for members of the human kingdom. Now, most of you, yes, I think most of you, were born and brought up in a Christian milieu. Why have you changed it to Buddhism? Consider this in the quiet for yourselves. I don't want you to tell me. Consider it for yourselves. For the present, here and now, let us consider Siddhartha Gautama. He was born in Kapilavastu, as you all know, the son of Suddhodana, the ruler of the Sakya clan, and his wife, Queen Mahamaya. A soothsayer named Asita predicted the prince would either become a universal monarch if he lived the householder's life, or become a Buddha supreme if he went forth from the life of the home into the homeless state. Suddhodana naturally wanted his son and heir to rule his people when he grew up. So, Siddhartha was surrounded with all sense pleasures to prevent him from knowing pain, loss, and grief of any sort. Suddhodana, being an adult, knew what going forth meant. Those who went forth left the home life because of suffering and so forth, or every kind of suffering. And he didn't, therefore, if he surrounded his son with complete pleasure all the time and prevented him from knowing suffering, then he wouldn't go forth and might become a universal monarch. But is this possible? Is it possible to do this? How could any child escape the pain? How could any child escape not knowing pain of at least some physical illness or mishap? Fever, cold, headache, tummy upset, measles, mumps, falling on the floor, the smashing of earthenware toys, which were made in those days, sparks out of fire. Remember, he was right up in the north of India, and during for at least 2 or 3 months, it's bitterly cold, and you have to light fires to keep warm. And sitting near them, you might get sparks coming upon you, and it would be quite against all the laws of nature if a spark didn't burn Siddhartha's skin. So there we are. Again, being bitten by insects, pricked or cut by thorns or sharp edges. I know all about these insects in tropical countries and in countries like India. During the season, millions and millions of mosquitoes will suddenly appear on the walls all around. And you will see a lizard come along and make a meal of each one after the other. I have watched this for, 19 years I have lived in Ceylon, so I know something about it at least. So you can't avoid seeing all that, seeing the destruction of living things and death from childhood onwards. How could Siddhartha escape fear of thunder, the howl of wild animals, or being left alone a few moments in the dark night? Because it's impossible to avoid all those things. They are there. And naturally there is a reaction of some sort of fear. Or how could he escape anger or deep hurt when young playmates, he must have had some young playmates, couldn't be surrounded all the time by old people, elderly people, who laughed at his discomfiture. Again, how could he avoid seeing dead creatures, insects, birds, lizards, reptiles in the gardens around? You're bound to come across them. And thus knowing death right from the beginning. And the fading of flowers, the withering and dropping of leaves, and their reappearance in spring. All children, therefore, experience the duals from infancy onwards. Unquestionably, Siddhartha must have been an unusually sensitive and extraordinary child. Now, this account which is given in some considerable detail, this legendary account, in the Mahapadana Sutta, in the Diga Nikaya. It's in the Diga, Mahapadana Sutta, the very first in the volume, first volume. Surely, it is sensible to take the legendary story with a pinch, or even a pinch and a half of salt. I mention all this because it lends point to the Buddha's words to the Kalamas. Now, when you study this about the Kalamas, read the whole discourse. I'm not going to read the whole, I'll just read the essential part of it, because the whole would take too long. The Kalamas lived in a place called Kesaputta, which was in the Kosalan kingdom of King of which Pasenadi was the king. Pasenadi became a close friend of the Buddha and his disciple. And the Kalamas of Kesaputta, having heard that the Exalted One was staying close by, came to see him. And they explained to him that certain recluses and Brahmins came to Kesaputta, put forward their own view, and proclaimed and expounded it in full. And having done that, they disparaged and looked down upon the views of all other teachers who were prevalent then. And so the Kalama said, hearing all these different views and the people contradicting each other and so forth, we feel doubtful and we waver as regards the living of the religious life as such. So the Buddha says, yes, Kalamas, you may well doubt. You may well waver. In a doubtful matter, wavering does arise. Now look you, Kalamas, be not misled by report or tradition or hearsay. Do not be misled by proficiency in the collections, the suttas, the pitakas, nor by mere logic or inference. Note, he says mere logic. The Buddha knows only too well that logic has its place. As a matter of fact, the Buddha played a very great part in restoring logic to its right place in understanding religion and religious teachings. Nor after considering reasons, all the petty reasons that people adduce, nor after reflection on and approval of some theory, nor out of respect for a recluse who holds that theory. But, Kalamas, when you know for yourselves these things are unprofitable, blameworthy, censured by the intelligent, these things, when performed and undertaken, conduce to loss and sorrow, then do ye reject them. But if at any time ye know of yourselves, note the emphasis, knowing by yourself and through yourself, these things are profitable, blameless, praised by the intelligent, when performed and undertaken, conduce to profit and happiness, then, Kalamas, do ye, having undertaken them, abide therein. Abide therein. Live in accordance, live in the spirit and the letter of the teaching. Now, we might naturally inquire, well, how can we find out whether these things are profitable and when performed, they are the right thing for us? The answer is by investigation of the Dhamma. The Buddha lays very great stress always upon investigation. He calls it one of the seven links in awakening. And he also classes investigation as one of the seven limbs of wisdom. Let us now return to the traditional story. He's surrounded by sense pleasures. One day he feels he'd like to go out into the royal park to the special plaisance which was for his for him to see this. And it happens that Channa, his charioteer, drives him, and he sees an aged man bent as a roof gable, decrepit, leaning on a staff, tottering as he walked, afflicted. So Siddhartha asks Channa, why is that man like that? And Channa tells him that this is an aged man. This is what happens when you are aged. And the Buddha asks his charioteer, Channa, am I liable to that? And Channa says, yes, everyone in the world, young or grown up, is liable to that state. And Siddhartha is deeply struck by this, and he asks Channa to drive him back to the palace. And back in his rooms, he sits brooding, sorrowful and depressed. Siddhartha's father, Suddhodana, calls Channa and inquires, how did the drive go off? Channa tells him all. Suddhodana is very upset, and he determines that he will surround the child, the young man now, he was about 16 apparently, surround him with even more pleasures and so forth. Because Channa told him that Siddhartha, sitting, brooding and thinking, said, shame on this thing called birth, since to one born, old age shows itself like that. Then the next, afterwards, later on, there's the second drive, another drive, and he sees a sick man, suffering and very ill, fallen to the ground and weltering in his own water, by some being lifted up, by others dressed. And Siddhartha inquires, what's the matter with this man? This man is suffering from illness, serious illness. And Siddhartha asks Channa to drive him back to the palace, where again he sits brooding, sorrowful, depressed, thinking, shame then upon this thing called birth, since to one born, decay shows itself like that, disease shows itself like that. The same remedy is applied by Suddhodana, even more pleasures than ever. In time, there follows the third journey, and this time he sees a corpse. He had never seen a corpse being taken to the burning grounds. And he inquires, what's all this about? And Channa tells him, this is death, that man is dead. And Siddhartha inquires, am I also subject to this? And Channa tells him, yes, you and all people in the world are subject to this. This is the end of the body. And so he drives back again, and he says, he's very upset, and he says the same thing. And Suddhodana, not having learned from previous experience, and not being able to see that the surfeit of the sweetest things, the deepest loathing to the stomach brings. Shakespeare, Midsummer Night's Dream, Act 2, Scene 2. Words spoken by Lysander. It's a pity Suddhodana didn't foresee Shakespeare. And Not having learned his lesson, he surrounds him with further pleasures. Then comes the last drive. And this time Siddhartha sees a wanderer, as he is called, clean shaven, shaven head, robed in yellow, and he asks, "Who is this man?" And Channa tells him, "He is called a wanderer because he is one who has gone forth." What is that, to have gone forth? It means being thorough in the religious life, in the peaceful life, in good actions, in meritorious conduct, in harmlessness, in kindness to all creatures. So now, when he hears that, he drives up, he orders Channa to drive up to the wanderer and asks him, or asks the wanderer himself, "Who are you?" And the wanderer tells him, "I am one who has gone forth." And he asks the wanderer, "What is it to have gone forth?" And the wanderer says exactly the same thing as Channa said. It means being thorough in the religious life, in the peaceful life, in good actions, in meritorious conduct, in harmlessness, in kindness to all creatures. Now note, Siddhartha says to the wanderer, "Excellently indeed, Master, are you said to have gone forth, since so thorough is your conduct in all these respects." Such is the legendary account. But how could Gotama, if his whole life till then was quite different from this wanderer's, so readily give his assent? How does Siddhartha understand what is meant by thoroughly living the religious life, good actions, harmlessness, and so forth? See, these are the difficulties which we have to encounter when we study the legendary accounts. And it is these legendary accounts which ultimately turn away modern people from religion, from the religion as such. Look at the rebellion against the legendary things about Jesus Christ. People nowadays say, "Oh, poof, what nonsense. Immaculate conception, virgin birth, and all the rest of it. Nonsense." It isn't nonsense. There is a profound meaning to it. But because it is given in that language for a people who are not ready to receive the real meaning of the whole thing, and the account has come down, it is as if the fossil has come down and the live creature that became the fossil is dead. So that is the trouble with these legendary accounts. But if we care to look into them, and we can only look into them by real investigation, which means ourselves living the religious life in the true sense of the word, not just have a merely intellectual curiosity about religion and religious teachings, which has to be satisfied. After all, there are hundreds of societies nowadays concerned with the different religions of the world as such. Why are they concerned? It's a job. It's an interest. It's an intellectual interest. They can talk about it. They can write theses on it and so forth. Get PhDs and whatnot. You see? It is that sort of thing which is not the reality at all. It's dead. It has to be living. This is where, of course, how could Gotama know? Now, of course, he obviously had an innate sensitivity, and this may have come into play, which made him sort of suddenly recognize, yes, this is it. Now, in the account given in the Majjhima, in his own words, in the Majjhima Nikaya, You'll find it in the Mahasatchaka Sutta, in the first volume, in the second volume, in the discourse to Prince Bodhi, and in the discourse to Sangharva Sutta. So there we are. In there, the Buddha himself relates that before his awakening, seeing that he was liable to dukkha, because he followed the un-Aryan way, it occurred to him, why do I seek what is liable to birth, aging, dying, to stain? Supposing, seeing the peril in all these things, I seek the unborn, unaging, undying, sorrowless, stainless, the uttermost security from the bonds, Nibbana. Now you know this is a statement which needs a very great deal of investigation. It's a statement which can be challenged all along the line. How can you seek the unborn? Supposing you've lost your penknife. You know what your penknife looks like and so forth. You have an idea where you may have dropped it or placed it, and you can go and look for it, and you will recognize it, recognize it. You see? But the unborn, how does one recognize the unborn? The unaging, the uttermost security from the bonds, Nibbana. You see, we read all these words. I've done this sort of thing myself for years and years before. I rubbed my eyes and woke up to what it could mean. You can't seek that which is transcendent as long as you are in the context, live in the context of the finite, the temporal, and the mortal. The finite can never measure the infinite. Totally impossible. It's the infinite which subsumes the finite, and so forth. But in you and me, there is this seed dormant in our own consciousness and in our own psyche, which could, if the right stimulus comes to it, if the right sort of stimulus and a sufficiently powerful stimulus comes to it, we can thrill to that and begin the awakening process. See, this is very important. But the statements as they stand are hopelessly illogical and just impossible. You can't seek that which is not born. Because the not born cannot age. You can't seek the unaging. You cannot seek the sorrowless and the stainless, because the sorrowful and that which is stained is what we actually know here. We don't know that which is sorrowless and stainless. We think of it as the opposite of the sorrowful. This is where we make our mistake. And all along the line, throughout the centuries, the theologies of the world have made this tremendous mistake of trying to interpret the context of the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal in terms of and in the measure of the finite, temporal, and mortal. And that is why all these theologies fall down. And there are always people who sort of have wasted their lives in an effort to pursue what was misinterpreted. And Siddhartha goes on, after a time, being young, possessed of radiant youth in the prime of my life, although my unwilling parents wept and wailed, cutting off my hair and beard, putting on yellow robes, went forth from home into homelessness as one who was in quest of whatever is good, searching for the incomparable, matchless path to peace, the sublime, unoriginated nirvana. Now that is the spirit of religion. So, in his case, it was the sorrow of the world, seeing one corpse, seeing one aged man, and so forth. piercing his sensitive heart, which made Siddhartha Gautama turn to religion to find deliverance from all ill. You know, very few of us ever pay sufficient attention and sufficiently fully grasp the significance of all these words which are in the texts. The deliverance from all ill. Now, how about us? I started by asking, why do we turn to religion? What about us? Is it not true that with most of us, our personal pain, loss, misfortune and sorrow turns us to religion? We might find a solution there. Look at the mental attitude and the spirit in which we are turning to religion. Something to gain for us in order to assuage our particular pain. You see the difference? It's absolutely tremendous. How sensitive is each one of us to the world dukkha, the Weltschmerz, as the Germans say? We must cross-examine our hearts and motives to the ultimate degree, else we only remain self-centered, self-oriented, self-imprisoned, and thus defeat living religiously. I know some of you want to go to another meeting, but I think I'll just tell you something which is quite true. 20 years ago, when we started in July 1962, when we started the Friday groups which I have held at my house. At the first meeting, we had about 6 or 7 people, and amongst them was one man who came specifically. He told me at the third meeting or so, he told me that he was disappointed with what he got, that he thought that he was going to learn from me ways of controlling his mind in such a way that he would be able to influence other people and make money. He wanted to make £1,000,000. So I said to him, what will you do? Why do you want to make £1,000,000? Oh, I can help mankind with £1,000,000. I know what to do. So I said, are you sure? And he said, oh yes, quite sure. Do you know the lives and histories of other millionaires? Not very much, but I'm quite sure that I'll do the right thing. I said, I'm very sorry, but that is something which I simply cannot do for you. And if I knew any such technique, I would not give it to you. He stopped coming after the seventh meeting. That was the end of him. For instance, supposing one is looking in a certain direction and sees a chair. Now, we have experienced chairs from the time we were children, right onwards. And we have a conception of it. We have a clear picture in our minds, what I call a mental card index. Now, that card index, you see, is a mental construct of what a chair is. And it's a descriptive index. It tells you things about a chair, that is this shape and structured like this, and its purpose is that, and so on. You see, so that is the way our personal consciousness functions, vijnana. It's a discriminative consciousness all along the line. Now, consciousness as such, you can associate with pure mind as such. Pure consciousness is pure mind also at the same time. Mind is the formative, universal, archetypal energy which releases cosmos out of chaos. I have repeated that 100 times at our group meetings if I said it once. You see? Now, this formative process is a process in terms of a transcendent awareness. And it is that consciousness which pervades the universe. Psychologists, philosophers, scientists of the academic type, they know nothing about this. You see, it's only the person who lives the religious life and is successful enough in living the religious life to have reached a certain state of sensitivity and clear-minded awareness which enables him to know this. Otherwise, it's so many words, as I said, you see. But to me, that is the fact. Now, the thing is that our vijnana has that in it which can respond to the universality of consciousness, of this pure consciousness. So that when vijnana operates in the right way, that universal consciousness is touched and it affects all humanity. I don't know whether I've read anything in the Buddhist texts, but in the Brahminical texts, that's very, very clearly pointed out. You see, it's rather a pity that when in studying Buddhism, one doesn't study what went before. Because the child was, not father of the men, the Buddha was unquestionably the inheritor of the Vedic teachings and the Upanishadic teachings, you see. And there it is clearly shown what this universal consciousness means. So that, shall I put it this way? If you drop a pebble or a stone in a pond, the ripples don't sort of stop there. They go on and on through the whole pond. And they are reflected back towards the point at which the pebble was dropped. Now you see, our vijnana is like that pebble which has been dropped in this universal pond. And so the entire universe of consciousness is affected by us. It's very important to realize this, because when you know how people criticize Buddhism and Hinduism and the contemplative life in general, Christian or otherwise, or whatever it is, you see, they criticize it as saying, well, what are these people just sitting quietly doing nothing instead of being up and at it, considering all the problems that we have facing us and all the difficulties and problems. They don't know what they are talking of. You see, if a person is really perceptive, he will see how sometimes just a look, a gesture affects an extraordinary difference in somebody's life. You see? It's like that. This sense of universality has been crushed by, particularly by the growth of the industrial age. And this crazy idea, the conquest of nature. Nature brought this thing into being and will uncomplainingly take it back when its period is over, you see. But man is so egoistic, so vain, so conceited, that he is determined to conquer this and conquer that. The conquest of Everest, for example. But Everest everlastingly rests. That's a very good, serious question you asked. Any other question? We talked a bit about the legendary account and how it can prevent us from sort of investigating it and understanding the reality. Take for instance this statement that his mother's name was Mahamaya. Maha is great, the big. Maya is illusion. Take the other account which is given of the Bodhisattva's birth, that he was enjoying in the Tushita heaven, you see. And of course everybody thinks that this is somewhere in outer space, you see, a certain height in outer space, which is the Tushita heaven, and there you enjoy all sorts of enjoyments. And he decides to enter the womb of the Lady Mahamaya. Can you really sort of picture that? Is it probable? Is it possible? What was there in outer space enjoying a Tushita heaven? It means here and now. Here and now, you see. He enjoys. He's surrounded by all these pleasures and sense pleasures and gratifications by his father. This is his Tushita heaven. And then when he decides to go forth, you see, he enters the womb of the great illusion, because when he goes forth and starts the ascetic practices and the meditations and so forth, which were to bring about enlightenment, then he goes through all the mistakes, the falsities, which the psyche presents and the psychical life. You know, I think, you know, Mr. Humphreys is so fond of quoting The Voice of the Silence. And it is a wonderful book of wisdom, really. Wonderful book. I think it is in that book, in The Voice of the Silence, where the disciple is warned against all the psychical impressions and so forth. And I know from personal experience up to a point how psychical impressions can put you on the wrong track altogether. You see? You see, until we are quite free of all our egoism and vanity, some state of mind which may uprise, some state of the psyche which may uprise, which pleases us, makes us think, oh, I've gone ahead, I've taken so many steps forward. I am now at the, I am in the sixth standard, you see, in the sixth form. Soon I shall be in the university where I'll get my certificate of enlightenment. All this sort of nonsense comes up in the imperfect human creature. We have to understand our humanity absolutely fully. When we understand it absolutely fully, the psyche is no longer a psyche. It's no longer your psyche. It has been completely transformed into universal mind operating freely through you, using your brain as its instrument for expression in the world. I feel that these are the sort of things we really ought to be informed about, at least to start with, because otherwise we just keep on making mistakes all along the line. We think of making sacrifices and so forth. How many of us realize that the meaning of making sacrifices is simply to make sacred? And what does one want to make sacred? Outward forms, images, rituals, books, written words, spoken words. The sacred, the innermost sacred, is the absolute which is embodied in the particular. Look at the movements like Billy Graham's and various movements of that type. You see these evangelistic movements converting people to the true faith. The converters themselves, it's questionable whether the converters themselves have faith or just blind belief of one form or another, and are driven by their own egoistic impulse. I want to do this. I am going to save so many people, bring them back to Christ or Buddha or whoever it may be. You see? That I is the worm in the apple. And they don't see it. All good doing, all right living, all righteousness happens naturally and spontaneously when the obstructions to that happening are out of the way. And that is, it's the obstructions we can see, and it is those obstructions we can deal with. We can't take something as the positive good and say, oh, I'll live like this, the good life. You can't circumscribe the good life in the confined sphere of one's own thinking. You can't think God or truth. You can be God or truth. Yes.
Question of faith being legendary.
Yes.
One reads that the Buddha was the teacher of men and gods.
Devas is the word used.
Yes, devas.
Devas and men.
Well, the Buddha, I understand, didn't think that he was going around teaching gods, did he? This is in retrospect.
Yes, yes, that's how it has been written about Deva Manusa, you see. And when he sends out his great arhats to teach all around, he says, for the weal and welfare and happiness of all Deva Manusa, devas and men, you see. They had, I suppose, their own conception of devas, but as far as I can make out from what is said in the texts themselves, both the Buddhist as well as the Brahmanical texts, The word deva essentially meant a being who had excellence. Who had excellence in any line whatsoever. Kings and queens and princes and such like were regarded as devas. We have the names of queens and so forth sometimes given as Devi. You see? The goddess. When people are in love, as they say, they refer to the girlfriend as a goddess. Is she? You see, all these things take place. A Homer, a Shakespeare, a Beethoven, a Bach is a deva, or a devi, as the case may be, you see. We have a devi here, Ikebana Devi. Excellent in their particular line. I think that's a very sensible way of looking at it. This is not invented by me, but as I said, there are statements in the texts which lean that way. And you see, the word deva or devi is derived just like the Latin deus for God is derived from div, the Sanskrit root div, which means to give or to shine, the giver of good things. You know how the theist will say God is the giver of all good things. God is the deva. But this God in this case happens to be a projection out of the brains of human beings. It's a projection, it's a thought, it's not a reality. You may ask, why do I say it is not a reality? Hundreds of millions of people have believed in this and worshipped and so forth. Look at the way God is described as an eternal, immortal being, an entity, a particular entity. In Catholic theology, God is presented as the wholly other than the Creator, as the wholly other than the created. All right, if God is an entity, He cannot be infinite, eternal, immortal. Every entity comes into being. Every entity is contingent. It is not absolute. You see, this is where the theologies of the world went haywire, all along the line. Somehow they never saw this point properly. I think when Eckhart presented the idea of Gottheit, you see, Godhead, and said that God comes out of Godhead, he probably did sort of see and understand, but he had to be careful, otherwise the church might have toasted him. Not with champagne.
He was lucky.
He was very lucky, yes. But he said extraordinary things. You'll find it in the second volume of Eckhart's works, translated by C.W. Evans. I think second volume, page 104 or somewhere there. Man verily is God. God verily is man. Now, Eckhart was certainly a person who clearly saw the divine potentiality in the living human being, which ties up with this thing. And we believe in one God, etc., and in one Lord Jesus Christ, the alone born Son of God, begotten of his Father before all ages. That means completely transcending time, before all ages. If you completely transcend time, then you realize eternity. Don't mix up eternity with timelessness. Timelessness is a human experience. If and when you can enter, really enter the profoundest meditative states, what the Upanishads call the turiya, what the Buddha called the cessation, and so forth. You see, if you can enter into those states, you enter into that state at some moment in time whilst you are sitting cross-legged, or whilst you are kneeling in prayer, or whatever it may be. Eh? And after a period of time, which may last as long as 7 days and nights, you emerge out of it, because the body compels that emergence out of it again. So this experiencing of timelessness is limited by two distinct points in time. So timelessness is not identical with eternity. Eternity underlies both time and timelessness. This I say on my own responsibility. I haven't read it anywhere or come across any philosophy which presents anything like this. They have all, even in our own times, Krishnamurti has sort of identified timelessness, the timeless with the eternal. It isn't so. Yes?
I am that I am.
Ah. Ehyeh asher ehyeh. Yahweh Elohim says that to Moses. And he says that to Moses when Moses inquires, if the Israelites ask me, who has sent you? Say unto them, asher ehyeh, ehyeh asher ehyeh. I, that is referring to Moses himself, I, Moses, am asher ehyeh, that I am, the transcendent supreme I am, Yahweh Elohim himself. Elohim stands for the total universal process. It's a pity that the translations of the Old Testament, and particularly of the Torah, Genesis to Deuteronomy, you see, in the translations in all languages, Elohim is translated as God. Now you see, God is a word which is very inadequate to express Elohim. Elohim is compounded of Ele, which means the eternal what, interacting with me, M-I, me, you see, interacting with me, which is the eternal who, that is the person and the object, the subject and I'll put it this way, the subject and the object, those two in constant creative interaction release the entire universe and release the entire process of development in human beings by living the religious life, which makes the Yahweh, which is immanent in the person, become united with Elohim, who is the universal manifested. You see, it's all very, very wonderful, really, if only one can get even a glimmering of it. So, does that help you? I am that I am. the one and only I am, pervading the totality. That is why I always say that each and every single person and thing in the universe, in the entire universe, is transcendence embodied. And this embodied transcendence has to be liberated by the embodied, out of the embodied state. This is what happens really with enlightenment. What is called Samasambodhi is just that.
Is eternity only a concept?
Huh?
Is eternity only a concept?
No. It's a reality. It's a reality which defies all conceptual and verbal expression. Some people credit me with the fair capacity for putting into concepts and words what most people can't. But I can assure you that I myself absolutely cannot conceptualize and verbalize eternity. I can only say this, that eternity is that which utterly transcends time and timelessness and subsumes it all. Subsumes it, you know, if you look in the dictionary, you'll get the meaning, contains it. But the word contain is can be misleading. You think of a box containing so many oranges or whatever it is. It's not containment in that sense. It's containment in the sense of the living reality, the ultimate reality, pressing out of itself a manifestation of itself. And that manifestation must necessarily therefore be limited, mustn't it? But it doesn't mean that a piece of the transcendent has taken lodgment in the existential being, the rupa, Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankhara, Vijnana complex. It doesn't mean that. Because then you get the false idea, my Atma, my soul, my spark of divinity and so forth. It would be very difficult to find the spark of divinity in a good few 100,000 people in the world today. Sir?
If reality is eternal, then surely it's time and the timeless which are the conjecture.
Pardon?
If reality is eternal, then surely it is time and timeless which are the conjecture.
Which are the conjecture?
They are the concepts.
Timelessness are concepts, yes. The word timelessness is a concept, and the word time is also a concept. But we experience our life in the world in terms of time and timelessness. When you're madly in love and you're dancing till 5 o'clock in the morning with your beloved, you think, my goodness, 5 minutes have gone by and look at the time. We're all mad. Well, good folk, shall we stop there today? Unless you have some important or interesting question. We can go on, the tape can go on a little bit. You know, it's a very, very significant and important thing. The Buddha would have nothing to do with conventional metaphysics. You study the Brahmajala Sutta very, very carefully, and you'll find him stating again and again that, but the Tathagata knows that which is beyond all this, you see, which cannot be confined to the realm of mere logic and reason, cannot be confined. It is beyond it all. There he is indirectly affirming, but yet categorically affirming, the transcendent. And of course, in the great there is an unborn, unbecome, unmade. If not, there's no release from this here, which is born, become, made. There's the categorical affirmation of transcendence. And this is where religion starts. And the whole of the religious life is concerned with the release out of that which is perishable into that which is imperishable. But don't mistake it. It is not I, this separate being, my peculiar self-consciousness, I am I, which is released into the transcendent. It's not that which is released. It's transcendence itself which is released out of its imprisonment here into its own self. And that is our human responsibility. Your pet dog or cat, sweet and wonderful though it may be, can never do it. You can. It's important. Nowadays, we should sort of try and get hold of this sort of metaphysics. Because modern science has taken us far enough to warrant a clearer expression of the metaphysical aspect of what we have discovered so far.
So really what we're looking for is our true home.
Absolutely.
Yes. Our true home is eternity.
Exactly. Exactly.
If all the parts are part of the whole, like the dog and the cat, you say, never realizes, and yet they are part of the whole.
Yes.
Why is it only the human that is able to do this?
Because
the segregation?
Because look, for any energy to manifest, for any consequence to come into being, there must be the right sort of apparatus. All the animal kingdoms haven't got the special apparatus that we humans have. You see, they haven't got that kind of brain, first and foremost, to start with. They have psyche. Universal mind operating through, and this is definitely Buddhistic. It is not my invention. You'll find the suggestions of this in Buddha Ghosha's Visuddhimagga. You see, mind, the universal energy interacting with corporeality, the body, gives, and this is what I have said, gives rise to what we call psyche. So that's why I never, now, for the last 4 or 5 years or more, I never talk of my mind or your mind or anybody's mind, but of their psyche. The psyche is yours specifically as your kidney or your nose or your toenails are yours. You see? But the mind is something universal. The Buddha uses the key phrase for all this. Vijnanam anidassanam anantam sabbato bhavam. Vijnana, that is the ordinary discriminative consciousness, he's talking of its development and its fruition, become characterless, anidassanam, characterless. You can't describe, that means no concept, there is no description possible. It's nondescript. Just as space is nondescript. Having said the word, you can't ascribe any characteristics. Anidassanam is characterless, anantam, endless, and therefore beginningless, you see, which really touches the idea of eternity. Beginningless and endless, anantam, sabbato, everywhere, pabham, shining. The Majjhima uses the word pabham, and the Diga Nikaya uses the same phrase, but ends with pahang, which means accessible. I think I've got it right. Wait a minute. No, I've got the... It's in the first volume of the Majjhima, you see. But there you are. Now, these things are very, very fundamental. And if we can compose our compose our psyches, get the psyche to be quiet, you see, instead of jumping about like a monkey all the time, and get the brain not to talk, keep talking back at the thing, and then study. In that quietude, the deeper things involved in what is said in the scriptures will come into consciousness.
But don't you think that the questions come from the monkey?
Oh, questions. The questions come from the monkey, all right. And the monkey has his birth, his uses.
If you be the monkey, well, most of the time won't be any questions.
True enough. True enough.
Especially because you are supposed, we say that, or we are taught, that in each question there is contained the answer.
Yes, yes.
Shouldn't we ferret it out instead of asking?
Purify the question. If you can purify the form of the question, it means that you have already obtained the answer. And then the question will be asked in the right way, and the answer will be simple, not complex, not complicated. This is where simplicity comes in.
Yes.